Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us. We'll begin today's show with guidance from the ACLU on what to do if you're detained by ICE. And we'll also dive headfirst into new national nutrition guidelines. We'll explore winter soup and noodle traditions with Chef Marty Lee of Noodle Sip. And we'll also hear about how the Chickasaw Nation is planting trees to protect both climate and culture. But we begin today's Main Street with our popular regional news podcast, Prairie Beat.
Hey, I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We're back once again for another episode of Prairie Beat.
Our weekly discussion of news headlines out of the Prairie Public newsroom. Okay, Danielle, what is on the beat this week?
Okay, well, I feel like in the last several days or so, we've lived several lifetimes, right? The news moves pretty fast these days. It's really hard to keep up. But so by now, most people are probably aware of the incident in Minneapolis last week where an ICE agent shot a woman in her car. That agent has been identified as Jonathan Ross. The woman was identified as Renee Nicole Macklin Good.
A woman is dead, and I think everybody feels awful and maybe even helpless about that. You're not wrong about it feeling like a lot has happened in the last several days. That shooting, now, I think, to set up the context for it, happened after some ramped up ICE presence and enforcement in Minnesota following federal attention on fraud in Minnesota, specifically focusing on Somali residents. Now, officials there have been working on those cases for a while and have prosecuted people involved. At the beginning of this month, the Trump administration deployed about 2,000 ICE agents to the Minneapolis-St. Paul area.
That's correct. And that's actually more officers than there are in Minneapolis and St. Paul police departments combined. So it's a sizable deployment. And as we've seen play out in media reports and on social media, it's a pretty aggressive and sweeping enforcement campaign. They've been very visible in those communities, which has led to protests. Now, when ICE encountered Renee Good in a Minneapolis neighborhood, that did result in her losing her life. And the community has continued to respond to that. Lots of protests have been ramping up. The state of Minnesota has announced they are suing the Trump administration to block the ICE action in their state. And then just yesterday, we learned that six prosecutors, including Minnesota's U.S. Attorney Joe Thompson, have resigned because the Trump administration was pressuring them to investigate Renee Good's wife instead of what happened between Good and ICE.
And in a little ironic twist, those prosecutors were investigating those fraud cases, which was the pretext to come into Minnesota anyway by ICE. So, yeah, now in the days after the shooting in Minneapolis, ICE presence has really fanned out all over the rest of the state. We've been hearing reports about Detroit Lakes and Pelican Rapids, a couple of towns close to our listening area. There have also been citizen reports in the verification isn't always as concrete, but that ICE has been spotted around the Fargo-Moorhead area. I've heard that anecdotally, Danielle, I know you have. I think when people look at these media reports and discuss it in social media and see some of these videos, now, at least this is how I feel. I'm sorry to say, but it's very scary. It's very unsettling. Some folks like to say, you know, if you're not undocumented or not a criminal, you don't have much to worry about. You've got nothing to hide. No worries. Well, okay, but we keep seeing these reports and stories of U.S. citizens getting detained and swept up in these ICE raids. And unfortunately, in the case of Renee Good, as well as others before her, we are seeing people lose their lives. That's scary to me.
And that's okay. You know, I always tell people that, I tell my kids specifically, your feelings are okay to have. If you're scared, that's fine to feel. But what do you do with those feelings? This week, I talked to somebody about that.
This is a public service announcement.
Cody Schuler. I'm the advocacy manager for ACLU North Dakota.
ACLU, of course, is the American Civil Liberties Union. They're a nonpartisan national organization that defends individual rights and liberties guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution, and each state has their own chapter.
Yeah, okay, I'm listening.
I do not tell my kids this, but I do tell worry warts in my life that worrying is not a productive thing to do. Now, that's not to say that worrying isn't normal or that I myself never worry, but again, it just doesn't accomplish much. So if you're watching what's been going on in Minnesota and you're having some concerns, Cody Schuler says the ACLU has resources available, and that starts with just being aware of the rights that you have just by virtue of you standing on U.S. soil.
Every person, regardless of your status, citizens, documented, undocumented individuals, all have guarantees of a certain amount of rights underneath the Constitution of the United States. It applies. And so what's really important is for people to know that they are protected, that their status does not necessarily determine what rights apply or don't apply.
Cody says the North Dakota ACLU website has a lot of information on there, but the best resource is really the National ACLU website. And he told me if you just Google ACLU immigration or ACLU know your rights, the page will come up. And I went to this website and it has this whole section with drop downs about what to do if you're approached and asked about your immigration status, what to do if you're stopped in traffic, or even what to do if there's a knock on your door. For example, if you get a knock on your door, there's this section of the website that instructs people to stay calm, to know that you can remain silent and that you don't have to let anyone into your home without a signed warrant from a judge. Or if law enforcement doesn't have probable cause to believe a person in your home that they're looking for is even there, you don't have to open the door to them.
Okay, so it sounds like Fourth Amendment stuff to me, Danielle, but, you know, the vice president has said, others have said, that ICE agents are going to start going door to door in Minnesota. So if there's a knock at your door, you can say, hey, you need a warrant to enter, or do they just bust it down? Where's the law here?
So the Fourth Amendment, like you just mentioned, that's the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. It protects people from unlawful or unreasonable searches and seizures by the government. Like you said, that doesn't mean you can't ever be searched or that somebody won't knock down your door, but you are protected from unlawful or unreasonable searches.
I would hope so. So, okay, so let's say I get all my reading done and I know my rights backwards and forwards. I got a constitution in my pocket. Let's say, what happens if I'm detained anyway?
Good question. So I asked Cody about that. There are resources from the ACLU about that as well. He says it's good to go through and really familiarize yourself with a number of scenarios that may happen, like getting stopped if they knock on your door, if you're contacted by the FBI or whatever. But he also says it's good to have a plan.
One of the things that we're promoting at the ACLU is a family safety plan. Actually, on our website, we have a downloadable PDF, multiple pages. It has information on there. It has QR codes. It has websites. And then it also has, you know, fill in the blank to be able to put information together so that you and your family are prepared regardless of what takes place. And so that would be the first part. You're familiarizing yourself with your rights, and then you're tracking, making sure that you have phone numbers of attorneys and a variety of things so that you know who to call, who your loved ones would know who to call, and that plans are in place and that you've documented that somewhere and that you have that available for your family.
So did Cody have anything to say about what we're hearing a lot of from the Twin Cities, trained observer classes? One of the claims about Renee Good was that she may have been a trained observer, quote unquote.
There are no current resources from the ACLU North Dakota on how to become a trained observer, but there are other resources online about that. So you can Google that and kind of see what's out there. Again, this goes back to the rights people have in this country as citizens and non-citizens. So, for instance, I know as a reporter and as a private citizen, I learned this a long time ago, like back in communication school. I can take pictures, and really anyone can, if I am on public property. It's actually legal, and I'm not saying this is like good ethics or the right thing to do or anything, but it is legal for me to take a picture of you inside your house if I can see you through your window and I'm on a public sidewalk. So yeah, there are legal rights for trained observers. You can't impede or interfere or obstruct any actions or investigations, but there are legal rights to observe actions, and there are online courses that do teach that.
Yeah, you think of Google Maps, right? I mean, they're on every street taking 360-degree photographs. I mean, maybe they're peering into your window by incidental or by accident, but there you go. Is the ACLU of North Dakota kind of bracing itself for any increased ICE activity in North Dakota?
He did say what they're doing is they're monitoring what's going on in Minnesota and keeping an open dialogue with their partners in that state. And another thing he said that I think is important is that while people are familiarizing themselves with the laws of this country and their own individual rights, citizen and non-citizen, et cetera, part of that may be encountering situations, and we alluded to this before, you know, where your rights are violated. And he said that starting with knowing your rights and having those plans in place for if that were to happen, it puts you on a more solid footing. He also said that a lot of people assume that the ACLU has like this massive bank of lawyers at the ready and that you can call them up and they'll connect you and get to work on, you know, fixing everything for you. But that's just a bit inaccurate. They do work on what he called cases of impact. But he says any attorney who works in immigration or civil rights would be someone you would want to look at. And the resources from the ACLU are there to kind of help you get in that direction and familiarize yourselves with that.
Well, certainly a lot of pretty interesting and very important information there, Danielle. It was very helpful as a neighboring state of Minnesota, too. Now, you know, you would think that President Trump is not targeting red states, but you never know. I mean, Minnesota is right next to North Dakota, obviously, and so you never know what might actually happen. It's undoubtedly on the minds of many people in North Dakota and pretty much everywhere right now. So with that, is there really anything else going on in North Dakota or the region this week, Danielle?
Well, we did have a story from Mike Moan this week about small towns in Minnesota worrying about ICE presence.
The community has worked hard to make them feel welcome.
The State Board of Higher Education has recommended three candidates to fill the vacancy on that board after Levi Bachmeyer was appointed state school superintendent.
I'm personally deeply passionate about ensuring that people do not feel like schools are political in any way.
And 2025 was apparently a good year for sunflowers in the state. And as a North Dakota farm kid who took a lot of family pictures in those sunflower fields over the years, that was kind of neat for me to see.
North Dakota's back up over $1 billion of production.
Ending on sunflowers, not a bad thing. It just reminds us of the beauty that is in our area that's just around the corner. Well, thanks for all that, Danielle. Lots of stuff to keep up with on the day-to-day and week-to-week in the Prairie Public Newsroom.
Absolutely. Be sure to tune into Prairie Public for more news or check us out online at news.prairiepublic.org.
All right, that'll do it for us this week on Prairie Beat. I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate Alliance Group of Bismarck, helping families reach their dreams throughout the Bismarck-Mandan area. More information at BillDeanHomes.com.
Main Street continues. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and today we're taking a closer look at the newly recommended food pyramid and what it means for everyday eating. National nutrition guidelines influence everything from school lunches to the choices families make in grocery stores. And to help us understand what's changed and why, we're pleased to be joined by Bryn Klein, a registered dietitian at Essentia Health. She works closely with patients managing chronic conditions and knows how confusing shifting nutrition advice can be. We'll explore the evolution from the newest food pyramid model, what drove those changes, and what experts have learned, and how people can put the latest guidelines into practice. Bryn, it's a pleasure to have you with us today on Main Street. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Bryn, why do national guidelines matter, nutritional guidelines, and how do they influence the choices families make?
Yeah, so as you said kind of before, the National Nutrition Guidelines matter because they serve as a basis for federal nutrition programs nationwide, such as schools, child and health nutrition programs such as WIC or SNAP benefits, and other public health initiatives. Families tend to look towards trusted guidelines when kind of family meal planning and all those kinds of things. So anything's established on the national level from an accredited institution is typically going to be what impacts those decisions for them.
So we all heard generally that there's now a new food pyramid. Some people have said that food pyramid has been turned upside down. Walk us through the newest recommendations and what does it emphasize?
Yeah, so looking at the food pyramid, you can kind of see at the top, more saturated fat food sources are kind of more promoted, such as kind of red meat, full fat dairy, and then on the other side, you'll see fruits and vegetables in kind of all forms, such as fresh, frozen, canned. And then we have an emphasis on whole grain sources at the bottom, rather than just a broad source of grains.
To me, the red meat and the full fat dairy recommendations were kind of a little bit of surprise. Were those significant changes kind of in your mind too, Bryn?
Yes, just since we haven't used the food pyramid model in quite some time and just reintroducing that. But the one misconception about the saturated fat recommendation is even though these are kind of more emphasized on the visual representation, the percentage recommended daily allowance stays the same as 10% or less of your total calorie allowance.
Yeah, I think that is kind of a, I guess, a misinterpretation that you would look at when you just look at the food pyramid that's been published. How would you suggest families or even individuals interpret now the new model, and what practical shifts might people make in everyday eating?
I would say, as always, families should continue to eat kind of a colorful and nutritious diet full of all food groups that fits best within their lifestyles. And as far as what changes to make, a lot of the guidelines actually remain the same in the literature, despite the different branding on the image.
So, do these have still real world impacts on school lunch programs, on food manufacturers, or public health programs? Have things changed a little bit?
Yeah, so serving sizes for whole grains is a little bit different, of course. But as far as how schools and other programs might implement kind of emphasis on these like red meats and stuff, as we talked about, it'll be a little, I would like to see how they manage to do that while still keeping it within less than 10% of
How
the.
does it impact you at Essential Health for people that are managing, say, chronic conditions or recovering from surgeries?
Yeah, so when I complete like a diet interview, which consists of the patient kind of providing a detailed summary of what they eat in a day, we can compare that to the dietary guidelines to see kind of where they might be falling short or even going overboard. But since the population I serve is mostly people with chronic conditions, the dietary guidelines aren't aimed towards that population, but rather more towards prevention. So once they have like a chronic condition such as like type 2 diabetes or heart failure, that's when I recommend a visit with a registered dietitian to curate a more tailored diet to fit their needs.
So, for someone who's really overwhelmed by changes, I guess, in nutrition advice, or they want to learn more, what are a few evidence-based principles that haven't changed, that have kind of remained the same?
Yeah, so long-term adherence matters more than kind of short-term diet intensity. So trying to maintain sustainable habits, so eating a diet focused on whole foods and a variety of colors to keep your choices flexible and to kind of avoid any rigidity.
I think one thing that the new guidelines emphasized maybe was something we already knew, and that is eat less processed foods. Can you give us some examples of what processed foods really mean? I think there's some maybe not certain clarity on what's processed in the grocery store and what's not.
Honestly, any type of food technically is going to be a processed food from growth to production to all those kinds of things. But what people may be more focused on is the added ingredients to certain things. And one of the food groups that's kind of more highlighted as being full of processed foods is going to be kind of your carbohydrate sources. Avoiding purchasing foods with a lot of added preservatives to them, maybe cooking from scratch when able. Just continuing to incorporate more whole foods, buying from fresh rather than, or even sometimes frozen rather than something with a lot of added preservatives to it.
When you look at something as a consumer for yourself, does this all mean more expensive food buying for you, or essentially, no, that's not the case, that our food budget can remain the same, yet we can still fit within these guidelines?
Yeah, so not necessarily does it mean it's going to be more expensive. I think there are plenty of ways to do it while keeping within a certain budget on the personal level for sure. But if we're going to want to limit processed food consumption in kind of places with little funding, especially schools and those kinds of things, we would need to probably increase funding for at least staffing to be preparing these foods from scratch rather than from frozen sources and that kind of thing.
What's a realistic best first step, Bren, that you could suggest to folks who can take this week to eat a little better, even though they've been eating a certain way for years and years?
Yeah, I kind of like to keep things fun and encourage people to try something new. So if they're at the grocery store this week and they see, I don't know, even just a new fruit or vegetable they've never seen before or never tried, I would encourage them to purchase that and kind of try something new.
Lastly, as we kind of wrap up our conversation, what myths or outdated ideas would you just love to retire and flush away right now, Bryn?
Yeah, I see with my patients a lot of the time that a healthy diet must require resistance. I like to think of it as what can I add to the plate to meet my needs rather than taking away.
That's Bryn Klein. She's a registered dietitian with Essentia Health. You can find more information about the new food pyramid online. Just Google food pyramid. And also you can look at Essentia's nutrition services on their website. Conversation has been good on Main Street. Bryn, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you.
Hi, I'm Danielle Webster, and I'm from a small town in North Dakota, so community is pretty important to me, and so is knowing the scoop. Like about Phyllis's sauerkraut dinner coming up on Saturday in the church basement, or the local theater group's production this summer, that kind of thing. If you want to know what's going on, or you want to let people know what's happening in your neck of the woods, go to our community calendar at prairiepublic.org. You can learn all about exciting events across the region and get our listening audience-wise to your organization's events. Just go to prairiepublic.org/community.
Still ahead on Main Street, Prairie Plates. We'll explore winter soup and noodle traditions with Chef Marty Lee of Noodle Zip. That's ahead right after this news.
I like bagels.
Some barbecue,
apple sauce, and some nice red beets.
Welcome to Prairie Plates here on Main Street, here on Prairie Public. I'm your host, Rick Keon. This segment is served weekly here on Prairie Public, and we're going out to Bismarck again this week. A lot of good restaurants in Bismarck, especially in downtown. The Downtown Burger Slam is going on. Go out and try one of the 11 burgers or all 11 burgers if you would like. This week, we're going to talk to Chef Marty Lee with Noodle Zip, which is a great Asian restaurant, Asian fusion restaurant on Main Avenue. Chef Marty Lee, welcome to Prairie Plates.
Well, thank you very much, Rick, for having me. Thank you for inviting me. It's going to be a lot of fun here.
You bet. Tell us a little bit about your background. You have a unique background. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yes. I have been cooking since 2003. I went to Culinary Institute of America, which is the most prestigious college of the cooking world.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. I'm also certified sommelier by CMS, Court of Master Sommelier. And my extensive background, starting from like working in the subway, you know, running an oyster shack, running a steakhouse, and you know, a lot of different places and this and that. Mostly focused on Asian restaurant. Was in the market partner and the chef at the PF Chang Northeast. And my dad had a job in North Dakota. And he called me to help him out, and somehow I ended up in North Dakota. And the next thing I know, I opened a restaurant back in 2017, and the rest is history.
Well, it's one of the best restaurants in Bismarck, I think, because I like Asian-style flavors, and your restaurant just hits.
Oh, thank you.
Put
thank
it that
you.
Way. Describe the restaurant to folks.
Okay. So we do Pan-Asian noodle restaurant, mostly focused on noodles. In the winter season, we focus on a lot of soup dishes. And summertime, and when the weather gets a little cooler, we focus on a little colder dishes or stir-fried dishes. But our bestseller is the hot soup dishes, and this is a perfect season to talk about it. And we do sell a lot of pho, a lot of ramen, and a lot of other hot soup stuff.
And the focus of this segment this week is soup, because it is soup season. It's January. It's cold.
It is.
And pho
is really good this time of year. I noticed a variety of ramen, and one trending Vietnamese soup is bún bò Huế.
Bún bò Huế.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. And we can talk a little bit about that, but first I'd like to talk about some of the offerings on your menu.
Okay. So we do have mixed of a culture because it's really hard to have a good quality, you know, a Vietnamese restaurant if you're just selling other than, like, per se, like pho, bún bò Huế. There's a lot of just, you know, preparation just going to the Vietnamese. But, you know, quite honestly, we don't have a big of a population just for specialized in Vietnamese restaurant and per se. So when I opened the restaurant, I concepted menu that can deliver all the deliciousness of the hot soup from the all pan East Asian side. So we do have some Vietnamese, like pho, spring rolls or summer rolls, goi gongs, and we do have some Japanese stuff like pork dumplings and shoyu ramen. We have Hakata ramen, which is based on the deep dark pork broth, and we do have some Korean stuff as well, some glass noodles and stir fries, and we do have some Singapore dishes and as well as Thai and other, you know, we change our menu every 3 months or so we can try to keep rotating and introduce the variety and the beautiful flavors of Southeast Asia and also throughout the whole Asia to the customers at Bismarck here. So instead of having them flying out over there and in, you know, I can provide them here. So I'll give you some of that experience that would might have locals over there. So we do prepare soups and stocks every morning and we make everything from scratch. I do not buy anything. We fold our dumplings, we get our whole meats, we prep and trim however we like. We get whole vegetables and we wash and prep and cut into the size that we need. And nothing frozen, nothing shortcuts, just a nice scratch-off kitchen that offers a beautiful deliciousness throughout the whole East Asia.
Let's talk about making some of the stocks for these soups. And we can start with pho, and I made pho quite a few times. It's a long process. It takes 10, 12, 14 hours. My apartment smells like
it is
beef for like a week. I shut the door to my bedroom and my closets because my clothes smell like beef. But it's a good smell. But you don't have to divulge any secrets here, but just a kind of basic stock recipe.
Right. So the beef, like I said, it's a very delicious and it's a quantity. So when you make it, we usually make like 60 gallon of the stuff ahead of time. And in fact, before I come here, before this afternoon, I started making soup for the next couple of days. So we always make the soup ahead of time for serving it the day next. But it's simply just a large pot of water and you put 20% of the bones, you know, however, you know, stock you're going to make. And 20% of meat. In this case, we use a lot of brisket and a lot of shanks to give that gelatinous, profile back to the stock. So it makes a nice viscosity. And we also put, you know, there's a two style of Vietnamese pho broth. One is from the south, which is the Saigon area or Ho Chi Minh City. And then the original place, which is the Hanoi, the northern pho. Northern pho tends to have a little less spice. Focus on more herbs like green onions and cilantro. Southern pho has more of a sugar. In our restaurant, Noodle Zip, we have half and half a blended style. So we put rock sugars, we put cinnamons, anise, clove, ginger, and toasted onions, toasted garlic, toasted ginger. Give that nice broth, simmer down minimum of 10 to 12 hours, usually going for from the morning all the way down to until we close, and then we strain the broth at the closing time for the preparation of the next day. But it's just pure, nothing but pure hearts and pure labor and good amount of beef that gives you a lot of beefy flavor. I'll just accompany with a nice Asian warming spices.
Any lemongrass in there?
No lemongrasses in fall broth.
Ah. Well, let's talk about some of the different varieties of ramen. There's obviously different flavors, different kinds. The
right.
broths, the stocks are all flavored differently. Tonkatsu is mm-hmm. heavy pork.
Right.
That sort of thing. Discuss that a little bit.
Yeah, we do. We serve 2 to 3 different type of ramen broth at each seasonal menu. Right now, well, classic, when we talk about ramen, there's a 3 major type of ramen broths. There's a shio, which is the salt, and then there's shoyu, which is the soy sauce. And then there's the miso, which is the bean paste. And then there are 3 main components, and then you have 3 different soup stocks. It's kind of, you know, a lot of variety. But clear chicken broth, which is just a regular classic simple soup. And then you have tonkotsu broth, which is the deep, dark pork, you know, cooked milky pork broth. And then you have a seafood broth or, you know, regular kaisen broth, regular, that you mixes with the other broths to make it more harmonious. We are famous for shoyu ramen, which is a very, very classic version, which the original version of the shoyu ramen founded in Yokohama. It's a Chinese restaurant originated from chuka soba, turned them into shoyu ramen. But it's simply just a shoyu, which is the soy sauce, the Japanese soy sauce, along with the mirin, and you got some, you know, some seafood stock, dashi, and make it into flavorful sauce base, and then you just add a little bit of clear chicken broth to give that balance. So it's a pack of umami, pack of deep richness of chicken broth, and you have some bouncy noodles, and you got some seaweeds, eggs. We also make the aji egg, which is the, like, kind of half-cooked. You know, the yolk is kind of still kind of liquid in the middle, soy sauce marinated egg, and along with some chashu pork, which is cooked cooked pork shoulder in special soy sauce mirin, and the same seasoning that goes in the ramen seasoning. But that is the style of ramen that we do and the most famous. And then along now, right now we have a winter season, so we expanded our menu for doing Hakata Tonkotsu Ramen, which is the southern style, probably most commonly known ramen style in Japan throughout. And it's cooked bone broth. So the bone is cooked down to where it's staged where it gets really, really milky and white. And you just skim out the fat, and with that pure bone broth, the milky rich broth, you just add nothing but just sugar, just some of the sugar and salt and white peppers, and along with the garlic. And we use thinner noodles, little wider thinner noodles, cooked short, and then gives you a little more al dente flavor when you eat the tonkotsu ramen, which is kind of key. And then some seaweed and same topping, you know, some mushrooms and some bean sprouts. And that's kind of like winter dish for local Japanese to have it on the every corner and every street size in Japan. And we try to mimic that as much as possible. We have a counter seating where people just come in and then feel the bustling and hustling and, you know, everybody's talking to each other and, you know, show off what they're eating and talk about that. And that's the main type of ramen noodles that we serve. There's a lot of other, you know, ramen noodles per se in generic ramen places, but those are kind of all fusion style. But we try to keep it as classic as possible and keep it as authentic as possible.
Let's talk a little bit about the noodle dishes, spicy noodle dishes. That's really good this time of year. I've really enjoyed the Sichuan Dandan,
right.
The dry pho, Korean glass noodle, Singapore curry. All of those are quite good. Some of them are spicy.
Right. Our the most spicy, famous, popular spicy dish is Sichuan Dandan. It's not quite authentic for that because original Sichuan Dandan noodle, they contains nuts like sesame, peanuts, and all that. And then we try to get away from a lot of, you know, allergic or dietary restriction. So I omitted all those nuts, and then we created a very clean version of it. So there's a lot of Sichuan peppercorn, a lot of chili flakes, but along with a touch of soy sauce and vinegar and sugar, that makes a harmonious, nice, spicy, sweet, tangy, cooked with the ground chicken, and then we just served them a bed of egg noodles and some crunchy vegetables such as bean sprouts and cucumbers, and then you got a lot of cilantro on top of it. So you mix it all together, give a nice little half saucy, half brothy, and a lot of sweetness, a lot of chilies, and it just makes a good harmony of crunchy, sweet, spicy, tangy flavor that just punches you throughout the whole meal. And then last thing you know, at the end of the meal, your tongue's gonna linger with that Sichuan peppercorn actions and a little numbness. But I mean, it gets down in your stomach. It fills your stomach. It makes makes your mouth happy. Makes your stomach happy. I mean, it's one of the great dishes that we have. And along with, we have other, you know, stir fry like Singapore curry. It's tomato based with some curry powders. Got a lot of crunchy cabbage actions with the thin, bouncy rice noodle with the plump shrimp, and just tossed and stir-fried in the, you know, and then we try to give them a little wok-hae, so get the pan hot and then get a little smokiness, and then serve with the crispy shallots and lots of cilantro and wedge of lime, and just nice tomato-y acidity balance, crunchy from shallots. And you know, it's good. You know, all the recipes are kind of set, and it's one of our best sellers.
This is Chef Marty Lee with Noodle Zip in Bismarck. Chef Marty, you have an event coming up for Valentine's Day.
Yes, we are. We have.
The menu looks delicious. Describe it a little bit.
Yes, we already have a Valentine's Day prefix menu. We want to keep it warm, elegant, reservation only, limited sitting kind of type of stuff. And then we have 4 or 5 courses that you can choose from. I'm just going to briefly talk about the menu. We have Korean beef tartare with some gochujang vinaigrette. And we make lobster dumplings. We are going to shell out all the lobster. We're going to chop it and then make it into a little dumpling. And then we're going to serve with the homemade lobster bisque. You can choose either filet of beef or filet mignon or butter poached salmon, and then it'll accompany with the chocolate gâteau at the end of the course. So you can choose between meat or fish as a main, you know, course, but it's going to be limited sitting. It's going to be intimidate just you and your loved one, and then have a great dinner, and then we're going to vibe it down with some candles and flowers and dim down the lights and make it super romantic.
And as a certified sommelier, it looks like there are wine pairings with these courses.
Definitely. We'll pair wines according to the menus, and got to see the weather on that day too. You know, we got to have there's good wines that pairs on same dishes on a different type of weather too. So we'll have to see that. But yeah, it's going to be a great course pairing throughout the whole meal, and it's going to be an awesome experience for a couple.
Chef Marty, anything else you'd like to add about your restaurant, being in the community of Bismarck, anything like that?
We've been since open 2017. I mean, we made it through COVID, and we have a lot of regulars that comes in, and we have a lot of support. But we always focus on a broth, whether it's pho or bumbo hui or shoyu ramen or even Valentine's Day menu. We always focus on soup and then making core recipe out of our soup. So lobster bisque is definitely one of them. But yeah, we're trying to bring the people together with the some Asian cultures, and I love to have that in Bismarck in North Dakota. I love it.
Chef Marty Lee of Noodle Zip, thanks for joining us today. We had a great discussion about soup, noodle dishes, Asian-style cuisine. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
And this is your host of Prairie Plates, Rick Dion. We'll talk to you next week.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 140 member rural electric systems in 9 states.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Travel with Rick Steves. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In southern Oklahoma, the Chickasaw Nation is planting trees to combat climate change. The project's also ensuring that Chickasaw culture gets passed down to the next generation. KOSU's Sarah Lisi has more.
You guys like playing in dirt?
Yeah.
What we need.
On a crisp fall morning, Chickasaw Nation Head Start students gather in a field at the Okeonolly Preserve, located on the tribe's reservation between Oklahoma City and Dallas.
Guys, let's go. Let's go plant the tree. Come on.
About 20 children are grabbing soil and packing it together to create a healthy foundation for 25 young trees. It's an effort funded by a U.S. Forest Service grant under the Inflation Reduction Act.
Here, Mavis, just put the dirt in there.
4-year-old Mavis June Wilson and her mom Julie were among the group participating.
What did you feel when you were planting a tree? Did you feel happy, excited?
I feel happy and excited.
Julie says she's Seminole, and Mavis is both Seminole and Chickasaw. Seeing Mavis cultivate a relationship with the land this young, Julie says, is important to her.
We used to live off the land, whether it was going and gathering or hunting or whatever, you know, the land always provides.
Yeah, that's a big root.
But the lands they are standing on now were not open fields before. There used to be more trees that prevented erosion along the Blue River and surface water runoff during storms. Katie Gillis works as the Director of Conservation at the Nature Conservancy, a global nonprofit that partnered with the Chickasaw Nation in 2012 to protect the lands at the Okeonolly Preserve. Gillis says this area was hardwood bottomland before colonization.
And after these lands left Chickasaw ownership, the ranchers cleared it entirely and turned it into meadow. And so we are actively working to restore it.
Restoring the land to its natural state will ultimately help combat climate change. More native trees can help filter pollution and cool the community when it's hot outside. But experts say that works best when the right species and number of trees are planted.
A few years ago, we planted over 4,000 trees and put sinuosity back in the creeks that feed the Blue River here to keep water on this land longer and to raise the water table. So the 25 trees that the Chickasaws want to plant here fits in perfectly with our restoration efforts.
But this work, if done correctly, isn't just good for the local environment. It's also personal to the Chickasaw people, says Jeannie Mosley, the Chickasaw Nation's sustainability director.
And the trees that we're planting today are all culturally significant trees. So we have bur oak, we have pecan, and these are all trees that Chickasaw people used to survive when they first came over here from our homelands.
Mosley descends from 3 tribes in Oklahoma, the Chickasaw, Kiowa, and Comanche. Like Julie Wilson, she remembers the imprint the land left on her people through her father's teachings.
He said that whenever you think about land, you have to realize that people died for it. So the people that have survived, it just kind of shows me that I am honored to take care of this land because I'm kind of keeping their memory alive.
The memory also lives on now with this new generation of young people like Mavis.
She's graduating this year, and this is something that she gets to do, and in another 10, 15 years, she gets to come back and actually look at the tree that she planted when she was almost 5 years old.
The tree Mavis helped plant is an oak tree. In front of it is a little nameplate showing both its English and Chickasaw names.
The tree symbolizes her, and she's going to go through changes in life, and so is that tree. And I hope that she remembers that no matter what happens in life, changes are always going to happen, whether it's going to be good or whether it's going to be bad. And it's just part of life.
The trees and the land here at the preserve are a reminder of Chickasaw history. And that no matter the adversity, these children and the land are finding ways to prevail. For KOSU, I'm Sarah Lisi.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
The FM Symphony presents Masterworks 3, Symphonic Giants, January 17th and 18th. The program includes Dvorak's Slavonic Dances with the Area Youth Symphony and pianist Tyler Watridge performing St. Sane's Piano Concerto No. 2. Information at fmsymphony.org.
This is Dakota Daybook for January 14th. The Alien Enemies Act of 1798 was intended to prevent foreign espionage and sabotage during wartime. It allows the president to detain or deport natives and citizens of an enemy nation. The act has been invoked three times during the War of 1812, World War I, and World War II. After the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, the United States moved onto a war footing with remarkable speed. Americans rushed to join the military, and manufacturing plants quickly shifted from producing cars and appliances to building tanks and airplanes. On this date in 1942, President Franklin D. Roosevelt invoked the Alien Enemies Act. While the internment of Japanese Americans is best known, individuals of German and Italian heritage were also detained. Located outside Bismarck, the Fort Lincoln internment camp held a total of 3,850 internees of German and Japanese descent. Japanese internees were sent there from the West Coast. While many young men of Japanese descent served honorably in the U.S. military, others renounced their citizenship in protest of the imprisonment of people solely because of their ancestry. They were assumed to be sympathetic to Japan and were considered dangerous, leading to their confinement in internment camps. Fort Lincoln offered better conditions than many other camps. Buildings were divided into dormitory-style rooms furnished with steel cots. German and Japanese prisoners were housed in separate compounds, and there were two kitchens, one serving food for the Germans, the other preparing meals suitable for Japanese dietary preferences. Even so, improved conditions provided little comfort to those confined there. One former internee described what prisoners called fence sickness, a term used to explain the emotional toll of confinement. Dr. Edie Friedman said, "After you've been behind barbed wire for a long time, even if you know you've done nothing wrong, you begin to feel like a criminal." This was especially distressing for American citizens who felt a deep loyalty to the United States. Today, the site of the former internment camp is home to United Tribes Technical College. In 2003, the college hosted an exhibit about the internment camp organized by the North Dakota Museum of Art. In 2025, the college unveiled the Snow Country Prison Memorial to remember those who were taken from their homes and held behind barbed wire. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Kristen Stewart is diving into the deep end, directing a feature about a competitive swimmer.
I've been gunning for this forever. I've wanted to do that. I mean, everything I've done has led me here.
What led the Twilight star to create a much more intimate film? On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
The Alzheimer's Association Minnesota North Dakota, with funding granted through the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services Aging Services Section, is offering the Dementia Care Services Program. With classes offered at many locations in Minnesota and North Dakota, this month learn healthy living, building foundations of caregiving, and how to utilize the 24/7 helpline available in more than 200 languages. Learn more about the Dementia Care Services Program at alz.org/MNND.
And that's a wrap for this Wednesday's Main Street here on Prairie Public. We're deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll take a look at what's next for rural health care in North Dakota, as policymakers and health leaders gathered this week to chart the future of rural health care. North Dakota Monitor reporter Mary Stoyer was there, and we'll have her as our guest tomorrow. And we look forward to seeing you again tomorrow, right here on Main Street.